Welcome to Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with a chronic illness of sickle cell disease. Today, we are speaking with Ashley Gregory from the Hemophilia Foundation of Northern California. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Adrienne.
As you and I were talking about the differences that I think you said to me that sickle cell was a disease, a blood disease, and that hemophilia was a bleeding disease. And I thought that's a nice way to sort of go into an explanation of what you with families with hemophilia are dealing with. So can you tell our audience a bit about it?
Sure. Thank you for having me on, Adrienne. So a bleeding disorder is something like hemophilia, von Willebrand's disease. Sickle cell would be considered a blood disorder, to my understanding. And I will look to you to educate me on that. But our bleeding disorder means that we bleed longer than other people. So in our blood, we're missing certain factors. For instance, in my son's blood, he's missing factor 8, and he has severe factor 8 deficiency, known as hemophilia A. Some people are missing factor 9 in their blood, and of course, you can have mild, moderate, and severe. Severe means you have less than 1% of that clotting factor in your system. Your liver does not make that clotting factor. Therefore, should you get an internal injury or have a bleed in your joint, it's going to continue to bleed longer and cause pain, cause deterioration in your joint. It can cause life-threatening bleeds. Many terrible things can happen. Luckily, many of us today are able to treat with the new medications that are safe and effective called clotting factor. However, many women in the community do not have access to that clotting factor because hormones can affect your factor levels. So for instance, when a man goes to get tested, his factor level could be less than 1%, say my son. Because my hormones fluctuate and I have so many different ones, when I go to get tested, my factor level can be 97%, despite the fact that I am still having bleeding symptoms. And this causes a real problem. The other problem that has happened with our community is that the hemophilia gene is carried on the X chromosome, which is passed on from the mother to the son. Now, I can't explain genetics. I always get confused, so please forgive me, and I always look to the experts on this. But what ends up happening is that the mothers pass the disease on to their children, and they end up sometimes being carriers. They're always a carrier if they've passed it on to their son. But they end up exhibiting symptoms themselves. But because their factor levels are high, nobody takes them seriously. And because we've always been told this is a male disease, no one takes them seriously. And so you have generations of women, and you can look down through history and see where they've had multiple infant deaths, miscarriages, mortality from giving childbirth and bleeding to death. In these families that have men that are diagnosed with hemophilia. Now, with von Willebrand's disease, getting a diagnosis is also a challenge because despite the fact that both men and women can have von Willebrand's disease, getting a good level on that clotting factor as well is difficult specifically for women because of those hormone fluctuations in our system. Luckily, the medical community is finally catching up, I would say within the last 5 years, And so there's hope on the horizon. But what this has done is it has mobilized the women into looking to each other and saying, well, there really doesn't seem to be much out there for us medically. What can we do for each other as a community? And so we started here in Northern California a program called the Female Factor. It's a play on words because Factor is the replacement medication that a lot of people with a bleeding disorder use. The Female Factor is women that are affected and connected in our community. And that's our motto, affected and connected. We are the mothers, the daughters, the wives, the sisters, the cousins, the aunts, the girlfriends, the friends of people who have a bleeding disorder. And we all come together and go to events. We learn about how to care for ourselves, how to care for our loved ones, how to help science help us. And when we started getting together, we all started realizing we are having bleeding symptoms too. And we are undiagnosed and untreated. And then we started getting a little angry about it and saying, gosh, what can we do about it? We've got to enact some sort of movement for ourselves. So we reached out to one of the national agencies and we asked them if they would support programs for us to do locally, here on the ground, kind of grassroots style. And people could learn whether maybe they have the symptoms of a bleeding disorder too. And it's been incredibly powerful. And to bring that point home, we had scheduled a 60-person retreat in Petaluma. And of course, as everybody knows, the wildfires ravaged that area. Our venue was not affected, but it was right in the middle. So of course they were affected. There's that affected and connected thing again. And so we shifted from Hell Week, what you would call the week before retreat, to the mode of how can we help these families who have been completely devastated by these wildfires. And people started gathering donations and gift cards and money, and then we started finding out that there are particular families in our bleeding disorders community that have been so devastated. In a particular one family that we learned of, this was a single mother. She has four sons. All of them have hemophilia. And they were evacuated in the middle of the night. They fled in their pajamas with no shoes, no belongings whatsoever, and their house burned to the ground. So the Female Factor dived into motion. And a bunch of us throughout the 47 counties that we now serve in Northern California gathered cash, gift cards, shoes, toiletries, clothes, everything we could think of that they might need. And one by one, loaded up our cars and drove things up to people that we knew that could get back into that area because the roads were closed. And when we dropped these things off to these people, this was a board member actually of our foundation, her eyes were just teared up the entire time we were with her. She was traumatized, and she was not affected at all, not even evacuated. But this has just this ripple effect that this is having throughout our community is going to last for months and months and months, and maybe years. So what we've learned is that we are definitely family. We love each other like family. The bonds are through our blood, and they cannot be broken. And although it is this tragic thing that brings us together, this bleeding disorder, and now these fires, we do find how strong we are, how much love there is in our community, and how much more we can do for other people when we're called to that task.
I'm just, my heart. You know, I speak a lot about the mother heart. And I hear that so strongly in just listening to what you're going through now. I mean, that resonated with me when I met you. I think so many times those of us who are caring for loved ones who have a chronic illness, who have a genetic disease, we so much of our lives, a lot of times, as you said, get defined around the battle that we're fighting on a daily basis to stay alive because of that disease, that it somehow, as you said, forges this connection, right? As you said, because of the disease, but then it grows, just as you said, it grows. And we have a family. I always talk about there is the family that you're born with, which a lot of times when you're dealing with a chronic illness, they'll succumb to chronic illness fatigue, which is, you know, if the healthy ones are feeling guilt or they're going on with their lives, and a lot, they sort of kind of can drop away from being there for you for every hospitalization, every scare. But our disease community / family is there for us in ways that we never really expect that to happen. And this story that you've just told is a perfect example of that. If people want to find out more about your organization, can you want to give us a little bit of background? I know that you're can be found at www.hemofoundation.org.
That's right. And we are physically located in Emeryville, which is very close to Berkeley. And our phone number is 510-658-3324. Also, you can reach The Female Factor at our email address, which is thefemalefactor@hemofoundation.org. And it's H-E-M-O, Hemo Foundation.
Great. So I've learned a lot in just our conversation here. You know, as with sickle cell disease, we generally, when we talk about it, it's the mother and the father both have to have sickle cell trait. And we have a 1 in 4 chance of each birth of our children, that particular child, to have sickle cell disease. In hearing about what happens in your community, it's much more complicated. There seem to be a lot more variables than what we are actually dealing with. Can you give us a little bit more information on the clotting factors? Is it the treatment? Is it a tablet that you're taking, these meds, or are there injections? How does that work?
Absolutely. So the clotting cascade is factors 1 through 13, and we're taught to look at them like a pyramid. So you have 1 at the top, and as your, say you get an injury, and you know, a lot of people think that somebody with hemophilia, if they get cut, they can bleed to death. That's not true, because in order to form a clot, there's 3 processes. You've got the fibrin, the fibrinogen that comes into action, you've got the platelet plug that forms, and then you've got the clotting cascade that happens. And so many of us are missing a portion of the clotting cascade. What we're also finding is that some of us are also missing that platelet plug that forms, and that's kind of a new area of science. However, for the clotting cascade, you've got factors 1 through 13, and each one, as it's activated, so on down the line, activates the next ones below it, sort of like a sequin cascade. And if you've got some that don't get activated, then the process isn't complete and you bleed longer. So my son uses factor concentrate, which is now created synthetically and very safely, and he injects it in an IV. This is something that we in the bleeding disorders community learned to do at a very young age. I started giving infusions, which is what we call them, to my son in our home when he was 4 years old. routinely every other day. And we do this to replace the clotting factor that his body does not make. Now, other people with bleeding disorders, say von Willebrand's disease, they might use a different clotting factor. They also have different medications that they can use. And for women, there's a lot of different options, one of them being hormone replacement, commonly known as birth control. Or there's the medications called Lystida, there's tranexamic acid, there's DDAVP, and these are the tools that the doctors use. This is kind of their arsenal to treat women with bleeding disorders because, as you can imagine, women have a bleed every month.
Yes.
So these medications are very expensive, this clotting factor. And in order to access it, many of us have had to kind of endure lives of poverty because it's so expensive that you can't afford it. So you have to have Medi-Cal or CCS or GHPP in order to access this clotting factor. So it's a real tragedy in that aspect as well. But we're grateful that we have this treatment and that at least the men in our community, their joints have been saved and they're not necessarily, most of them anymore, dying from life-threatening bleeds. That wasn't always the case.
I remember when that wasn't the case. I remember that. I remember being, because as living with sickle cell disease, with my daughter, or even with my brother, who when we would go to the hospital, we would run into docs who would, I don't know, now that I think about it, I'm not quite sure why they would bring, but it would always be this discussion about, oh, you know, again, this blood versus bleeding. And they would have these conversations about how many males in particular that, you know, that they lost due to hemophilia. And in some way, maybe they thought they were bringing comfort to my mother, that at least she still had my brother. And I just remember my mom coming home, and, you know, there's always this kind of thing where it could be worse. And she would actually say that, you know, he's still here, you know, he's still here, compared to hearing the stories of how many boys that were lost to hemophilia.
Oh, Adrian, you're so right. So they weren't necessarily lost to hemophilia. And yes, so the general life expectancy of a hemophiliac in, say, the 50s, parents were told your child will live to be 11.
Yeah.
Then they started to treat with cryoprecipitate and fresh whole plasma. And then that pool got tainted in the 80s. And the medication that they were manufacturing used that tainted blood and was distributed throughout the hemophiliac community. And then knowingly, they were allowed to continue using it. So they actually died from HIV and AIDS and Hep C. However, you still can die from a bleed. And unfortunately, my son Anthony died at 11 months old in 1999 because his doctor swore up and down that he had the flu when in fact he was having a head bleed. He was bleeding inside his brain. And I had chosen this pediatrician because she had successfully raised a child in her practice. She had treated a child in her practice from infancy to adulthood that had hemophilia. And I trusted that. That made me feel confident. So when she said he didn't have a bleed, he has the flu, he's fine, take him home, I believed her. Well, indeed, he did have a bleed. But what I think happened, and I cannot speak for her, but of course, we haven't spoken after this. She wouldn't speak with me. what I suspect happened was that she was of the old school thinking in that you don't give medication and unless you absolutely have to, because it was tainted. And she didn't realize that this was a new day and the medications were safer now and you could give it and not worry. So this tragedy still happens. I still hear about people not being treated properly, about my sons were twins. So my son Anthony that died was 11 months old, but his twin Nicholas is now 19. And I still hear about his peers having a head bleed and not getting treated, having an ankle bleed and not getting treated. So there are still strides that need to be made. But yes, back in those days when your mother, I suspect, was in the hospital, what was happening was those men were dying from all of those horrible infectious diseases.
Right. I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry.
I know. We talked about your son, but it just, you're just, you know, you've lived through my worst nightmare and you're still standing and still fighting. I just,
well,
yeah,
you know, okay. Yeah, know. So let me get real with you, girl. I don't sleep very well at night.
Yeah.
Because I'm haunted by what I could have done. I don't know if you want to save this for.
Yeah, no, I think we need to talk about it, because I think when you said to me about, you know, the doctor not speaking to you afterwards, and we have this belief that the doctor is going to lead us in the right way, that we do our research, that we're putting our children in the hands of the most capable person that we can find, that we're doing all the things that we can do, short of somehow swapping physical bodies with our children so that we take on the disease and our children have the gift of whatever health it is. You know what I'm saying? That we have, that we can switch places. And then things go badly, that we have to live through the experience of losing our child. You know, I don't know. I mean, help me here. Help me.
Yeah, no, sorry, just didn't want to interrupt you. And if we were in person, this would be easier. We could get those visual cues.
Yeah.
I blindly believed everything that doctors told me. And I was raised in a family that really didn't have any medical issues. And if you look back, well, if I look back, I see we now know that I'm a carrier for hemophilia A. So I actually did have quite a few issues. However, they were just sort of chalked up to, oh, that's just the way I am. But fast forwarding to having three, so I have three older children. I have a daughter that's 27, I have a son that's 25, and I have another son that's 22. And then I have my twins with hemophilia. Those other three children really had no significant health issues to speak of. We just did routine doctor visits. I always believed the doctor. I listened to everything they say, and I never questioned anything. I never had a reason to. So when I was given the gift of these two children with hemophilia, I just did the exact same thing. And I really didn't educate myself as much as in hindsight I would have liked to. And I didn't know what I didn't know. Now, there's a couple of times where when I look back, there were some crossroads. There was one in particular when I was in the treatment center and my son's were diagnosed at birth, and it was a few weeks later, and we were told that we had some decisions to make. And they said, you can put your sons on a treatment of prophylaxis, which is what my son does now, And it's where he replaces that clotting factor on a regular basis so that he's quote unquote like you or me. Well, I thought that was a great idea and I wanted to do that. And of course that my son would be here now, but they talked us out of it. They said, your babies are so young. Trying to get a vein on a tiny infant is just a nightmare. And why don't you wait and find out what their disease is like? Find out how they bleed. Because as we now know, many different bleeders of the same severity bleed very differently. You can have some that don't have to use the medication more than a couple of times a year. And then you've got my son who needs it every other day and sometimes more. So we listened to them and we said, okay. And so, again, 11 months later, my son shows up with these symptoms and my inner voice was screaming at me, he needs factor. But I said it to the doctor and she said no, and I didn't question. So now, despite all the work I've done with post-traumatic stress disorder, with bereavement, I am still haunted at night. I wake up with what I should have done. And I live with the fact that the mortality of my children is not anything to take for granted. When my son, who is 19 now with this bleeding disorder, has anything happen, it still throws me into that triggered trauma state. He is having his wisdom teeth pulled this Wednesday. And I'm freaked out. We have to show up tomorrow morning at UCSF for oral surgery, and it's inpatient because of all of this medical stuff. And I'm sure it's going to be fine. But I haven't slept for like 4 nights. Despite, and plus with the stuff with all the fires, but it's real and it never goes away. It never goes away. So, yeah, I guess I don't really know what to say after that.
Yeah, well, we're going to take a break. This is Access Advocacy, and we're speaking with Ashley Gregory. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment on thepowerofvoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Adrienne Shapiro on Access Advocacy via thepowerofvoices.com. And today we're speaking with Ashley Gregory about living with hemophilia.
Hi, Adrienne.
Hi. In our last segment, we were speaking about the loss of your son. And I still have my daughter, but in the last year, I have lost three people who in our community, who I worked closely with. And with the last one, I had known this young woman since she was 8 years old. And in the last 10 years, she had a child. She'd actually lived with us in our home for a year. We were sort of she was going through a court battle with her child's father, who was, I know, pretty terrified of the fact that she was as unhealthy as she was, or that he thought she was. And they were in a custody struggle. And on the last day of her life that morning, I was begging her to go to the hospital, to go back to the hospital. And her mother was there, her birth mother, and I was pleading with both of them. And they were not, they clearly didn't feel the urgency that I did. Mm. And I said, you know, please go back. Clearly, you know, you're not right. This is not normal. If you can have normal, and to me, meaning I had seen her in crisis before, I had seen other people kind of in the same state. And anyway, I agreed to leave. I said, I'll leave. I'm just going to, you know, after begging, please, please, you know, take her back. And I said, you know, I won't be far away. And within an hour and a half, I got a call back from the mother who just was screaming through the floor, phone going 911. So I knew what that meant. So when I got there, I'll never forget, I pull up in the street and there's, you can't, they're in a cul-de-sac and there's like no place to park because there are all these emergency vehicles. You know, there's a fire truck and paramedics and there's everything. And I just sort of parked my car and went running up the street. I saw that mother's face and I grabbed her child and because I didn't want the baby there for that, and I put her in the car and I just left. Well, they were able to revive her. They took her to the hospital. They did all the things that they could do at that point. But she passed away. And I am experiencing something very similar. I think, why didn't I call 911? Why did I, you know, listen? I mean, and I'm a fighter. You and I kind of talked about that, and I was telling you about how, you know, my mom had me so feisty because she fought for my brother so hard and taught me to fight. So I know that I'm unusual, especially for our generation to question doctors. But that was because my mom had taught me to fight.
What a gift.
Yeah, but I think, you know.
But still.
And, you know, that mom, of course, went, you know, doesn't talk to me now. I don't know how to, I can't fix it. I think she thinks I blame her. I don't. I blame me. I mean, I do, of course. Because, you know, I'm the one, I'm this fighter. My job is to, I still have my daughter. It does not go away. As you said, I mean, again,
never.
She wasn't my child, but it is the thing of if I could have. And I think it's up to us that are in the battle, staying in the battle, staying committed to comfort each other when we go through, as you said, that this post-traumatic stress, that we have each other and say, you know, we did everything we knew how to do at that moment.
Absolutely.
And we,
you know, so many people have said to me, what could you have done? Well, we know what we could have done, you and I.
Yeah.
We could have insisted. And I think that's what happens to us, is that we become the strength that equaled that terror and that regret that we now carry with us. And there's a velocity to our conviction that we won't let this happen again. And so when I met you, I was thrilled for pumpkin seeds. That's all I'm going to say.
Yes.
But I saw you buzzing around and I said, I like her. I don't know why, but I like her. And then you were hungry and I said, you know, should I give her some of my pumpkin seeds? I thought, oh, she's going to think I'm one of those California weirdos. And then I said, oh, just do it. It was that voice. And I listened. And, you know, I'm wondering, would we have made such a connection had I not done that? But I listened to that voice, and I'm practicing the continuance of listening to that voice so that I can prevent this stuff that happens, at least in my world.
Well, you saved me that day. I was very busy. We were, of course, we met at the Sickle Cell Conference in Fresno. And I was very, very busy doing things. And of course, hadn't taken care of myself, hadn't eaten. And there you were suddenly mm-hmm. like this, you know, knight in shining armor with your offering of pumpkin seeds, which really saved me because I was running again on empty, as which happens to us, right? We're kindred spirits.
Always.
And you said something really interesting. It is that listening to that inner voice. I think culturally, a lot of times we're taught to be nice girls.
Of course.
And nice girls are, they make nice, right? They're, I don't know if there's so much. They're quiet. They're polite, soft-spoken.
They don't ask a lot of questions.
Yeah. And I know that you're absolutely right, that what happens is that nice girl gets overridden by sheer terror. Mm-hmm. I think it is the fear of, if I don't speak up, if I don't do this, then the worst is going to happen. We know it can happen.
Right.
We know we must do it. But let's talk a little bit about your journey. So you said something very important. You said, I got educated. How would you recommend, or do you recommend to new mothers who have gotten a diagnosis of their child with hemophilia? How do you suggest to them that they start this journey of educating themselves?
Well, first of all, I would say any diagnosis, whether it's a bleeding disorder or sickle cell or anything, this applies across the board. And luckily, things are so different now, but my sons were born in 1998 and the internet was brand new. And I mean, it was just painful to search for things, but we did it. But I didn't know what I didn't know. And I think that's become a real important mantra for our community, because when you don't know what you don't know, that can be dangerous. And so going outside of our comfort zone and seeking out conversations with people that we wouldn't normally talk to, like doctors and scientists and people in Facebook groups that have to do with the particular disease state that we're concerned about, those are some of the greatest resources. Our national organizations for hemophilia, we have the National Hemophilia Foundation, we have the Hemophilia Federation of America, which I'm a board member of, and we have locally the Hemophilia Foundation of Northern California, which I'm a volunteer for, and I'm sure that Sickle Cell probably has those same types of organizations that people can turn to. And then on Facebook, there's lots of groups, there's Hemomom, and I would start saying, tell me what I need to know. Tell me what you needed to know and you didn't know. Those are the questions that I would be asking if I was a new mom today.
You know, you're right. When I hear you say that, I think about it. What a wonderful gift the internet is in that sense. I know you, I'm saying this with caution, of course. You've got to, and you've done a great job of outlining the national organizations that they should be, you know, you have really strong national, local, and regional organizations just to make sure that you're getting the best information that you can. And you also mentioned a mom group. For me, that was one of my my happiest moments, was when I, you know, discovered when I first started out, we didn't have a local support group. So we did a group in my house, and we would meet once a month, and everybody would bring their children, and we organized bake sales. But
I love it.
The joyfulness that the joy that really came with us moms getting together was really in realizing that we were not alone. That those thoughts that went through our heads at midnight, other mothers were having the whole thing of the not sleeping because you're so worried that in our community you're listening for that sound that the kids would make when they would be in pain. So you were always listening, but you thought you were the only one, and the sheer comfort in being in a group who understood your experience. I would say to anyone, like, you find a group, and I hate to, I know in this day and age, I think a group of moms, if you're a mom, because there are things that we are programmed for as women and as mothers that when it comes out with protecting our children, it really brings these traits and this way of dealing with things that I think is kind of primal that I don't think men really understand. So I'm just going to put that out there. I mean, they have a whole other way of dealing. I mean, I know with Ron, when he goes with Marissa, I mean, he does his, he's more of a papa tiger, you know, he sort of gets in there and, but shows his teeth. But I think, and I think of moms with children with chronic illness as being like polar bears. I mean, I think that we're the fiercest moms, I think, in that, and we're teaching our children really to survive in the harshest of environments. I think hospitals and the medical field, it's harsh. I mean, you go there because you have to go there, and, you know, it's, but we have to teach our kids so much, not only how to sustain themselves, how to protect themselves, how to figure out, how to read the environment that they're in. Is this a safe environment? Mm-hmm. Is this not a safe environment? Particularly with sickle cell, you're having to read every single person that comes in because they are going to, based on so many factors, make a judgment as to whether or not you're really sick. We get that all the time. Or whether or not you really are in pain. So, you know, we're just teaching our kids to be, I want to say, ever vigilant at the time when they should be taken care of, you know, when they're at the place where their needs should be taken care of. And I saw on your website, you do have you have a group for women, and then there's also a group for men.
Yes. So, I have to backtrack a little bit. And it ties in. That sense of overwhelm and that sense of the cloud of doom hanging over us as we enter these institutions where we're going to seek help has traumatized, I'm sure, your community. It's traumatized our community generationally. And I want to extend an invitation to all of the sisters in the sickle cell community to attend our retreat. So our group is the Female Factor, and we did reschedule this retreat, and it's going to be February 16th, 17th, and 18th, and we have room for 60 women, and we do have many women from the bleeding disorders community coming, but we've got some room for some sisters from the sickle cell community that we would love to have because, Adrian, I listened to as many of your podcasts that I could get my hands on. I was enthralled, and I'm so impressed by you. And I told my co-chair, you have to listen to these, so I gave her some homework. But the struggles that you all face, they're parallel to the struggles that the hemophilia community faces and the bleeding disorders community. As you can imagine, if you're bleeding into your joints, that's very painful. And our community also gets labeled as drug-seeking and opioid-seeking. And it's just this horrible round-and-round nightmare that we've been going through. And so I really feel a simpatico with your community. And I really think that we could join forces and help lift each other up even more than we've already been lifted up by our own community.
Okay, so once again, can you give us a little bit of information again about the retreat? Or do you call it are you calling it a retreat?
It's a retreat, yes.
Yes.
So, it's the Female Factor Retreat. It's our third annual. The first two were held in Santa Cruz at a house on the beach, and unfortunately, we got so big that we outgrew that paradise location. So we've moved up to Walker Creek Ranch, which is located in Petaluma. It's 8 miles in the middle of nowhere. There is no cell service out there. There's Wi-Fi, though, and there are landlines. So prepare for that. But we have a weekend planned of self-care, and it's going to include things like Qigong, learning how to ground, identifying triggers and what you can do when you feel them. We're going to have courses on post-traumatic stress disorder called The Body Remembers. Going to have a genetics and relationships course, so kind of, planning your life. And well, a lot of us have to include our genetics in that, which other people don't have to even think about. We're going to have a new treatments for women in the bleeding disorders community session. We will be having Wendy Aronson, who is a wonderful yoga teacher, come and do some twilight yoga with us. And we just anticipate to have, and the infusion class. Sorry, I almost forgot about that. So the first ever Northern California self-infusion class for women. And in our community, you have to have a prescription in order to infuse. So you would want to bring your prescription medication with you. I'm not sure how that goes for sickle cell, but this class is going to include everybody, whether you infuse or not. So, we're super excited, and we just want to open our arms and welcome you guys the way that you've welcomed, I feel like, me and the entire Female Factor group into your podcast here.
Well, we are going to be there. And we were so looking forward to it. And my hope is that we are joined together in this struggle with all the things we have in common, which is basically that mother heart, that love for our children, that ability to put ourselves in other people's shoes, the true desire that everyone have the best life and the healthiest life possible. And then I really believe that all of us working together and using all the tools that we have that mothers generations ago, I mean, as you talked about in your, you know, family about, you know, babies sort of dying mysteriously or in young men passing and, you know, mothers burying their children. That's the same story we had in our family. You know, uncles or great-great uncles who passed away, babies who would be fine and then sick, mysteriously dying. And now we know, we have a diagnosis, we understand the genetics. We are on this cusp of having cures through new medicines, through new technology. We have this great thing looming, leap of health in stem cell research. And we're so fortunate to be here now, if you could be fortunate living with a life-threatening disease. And you know what? And we have the tools now and the ability to join together and help each other. And I just want to say we're so happy to have you. I'm sure we will talk again with another podcast. And if our listeners would like to find out about the retreat or more about your organization, they would go to www.hemofoundation.org. Is that correct?
That is, and they can also email my co-chair and I at thefemalefactor@hemofoundation.org.
Well, thank you, Ashley Gregory, for joining us today on Access Advocacy. We'll be back in a moment on thepowerofvoices.com. Well, we're all out of time today, but before we go, I wanted to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's axisadvocacy.org. Join us again next Tuesday on thepowerofvoices.com at noon Pacific, or listen anytime on demand at accessadvocacy.org. You'll find all our programs there. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. Thank you for listening.